The Guardian.
It's a great pleasure to welcome to The Guardian today Richard Dawkins, Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University and author, among other books, of The God Delusion, The Selfish Gene and The Blind Watchmaker. Also here in the studio is Madeleine Bunting, a former Guardian religious correspondent and now columnist for the paper, who writes frequently about what might loosely be called religious and ethical questions. I'm Stephen Moss, a staff writer on the paper, and the only reason I can think that I've been asked to chair this discussion is that I've just returned from a week living with the monks of Mount Athos in northern Greece, the Holy Mountain, as they prefer to call it, a regular haunt of Prince Charles and home to some of the most intensely religious people and the finest beards in the world. Professor Dawkins, in the last few years, religion has come almost to define what you do. Is that a problem for somebody who has a much broader remit than just writing about religion?
Please call me Richard, by
the
way. Yes, I mean, in a sense, I've always been interested in it because as a scientist, my feeling is that religion is a kind of scientific problem. I actually do think that the question of whether there is a supreme intelligence in the universe is one of the most important scientific questions that there is, in the sense that if it's true, if the answer to it is yes, then the universe we're living in is a totally different kind of universe, scientifically speaking, from if the answer is no. So I can't go along with my scientific colleagues who say something like, oh, well, religion's a quite separate issue, nothing to do with science. We're not interested in religion. We just get on with our science. And if you happen to want to be religious as well, that's your privilege. I don't think it's your privilege. I think it's a very, very important scientific decision you're taking.
Does it though get in the way of the science? And I wondered if your title should no longer be Professor of Public Understanding of Science, but of Public Understanding of Theological Error.
Well, I'd rather not, because actually, I mean, the largest book I've written, I was published in 2005, is The Ancestor's Tale, which is a very large compendium of scientific information, which I don't think mentions religion at all. And most of my books have actually been about evolution from a purely scientific point of view.
How do Oxford's many theologians treat you?
We get on extremely well, very civilised and friendly.
Now, Madeleine, you've criticised some aspects of Richard's work. What in particular has bothered you about the position he's taken?
Well, in many aspects, there is clearly common ground between Richard and I. I think both of us would say we were deeply troubled by sort of forms of religious fundamentalism which are on the rise in the world. And I think my main problem really comes down to what does one do about these expressions of religiosity? I think I am really concerned that the particular strategy Richard's taken, which you describe as ridicule, let's laugh about this, let's split our sides laughing, seems to me to be very, very unconstructive. And I would argue on two levels it's really problematic. One is that the West is the one area where there's significant agnosticism, atheism and secularism, that actually the vast majority of the world is still deeply religious. So that this enormous global responsibility we all have to actually communicate with each other and try and find common solutions, I can't see how laughing till we're splitting our sides is going to help that very difficult process of negotiation. And also it seems to me that there's an issue here within our own country where we have particular minorities with very, very deep sense of religious identity. And I would agree, I think, probably with Richard that we're not quite sure what the religious component of that is. But, you know, how British society accommodates this new experience, it's accommodated previous experiences of migrant religious identity very successfully, and Irish Catholicism was one. So we're in a territory here which is not entirely unfamiliar, but we need to be careful. And it seems to me that splitting our sides laughing at a minority who are economically very marginalised and very insecure is not going to help us on that front either.
Do you accept that, Richard? You've sometimes used ridicule as a tool.
No, I mean, I certainly don't want to split our sides laughing just at a particular minority. I mean, obviously you're talking about Muslims. I'm indiscriminate in my humorous response to all religion and belief in fairies, etc. Now, I think you've raised an interesting point, which is that we are all secularists, certainly here around this table.
And I suppose the significance of that, of course, is that I come from a religious tradition and I'm very, very interested in my own tradition of Catholicism and also my tradition of Buddhism. So I think the point that I would just want to make is that doesn't stop me being a secularist. So just to clarify
but
that.
How can you both come from the tradition and be a secularist?
Because you're arguing that there is a public realm in which your religious opinions should not take dominance, that they are part of a plurality of religious opinions, and therefore that the public realm in many respects remains entirely secular.
I mean, that's easy. I mean, all the great, not all of them, but a lot of the great secularists have been religious, from many of the founding fathers of the American Republic to Gandhi, etc., Nehru. Well, Nehru was an atheist. But now, so we are secularists and we want to keep religion out of public affairs. We want religion not to interfere with government, religion to be a matter of private conviction, but you don't force your religion on other people. That's the kind of thing one means by being a secularist.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, there's one or two points along that sequence of statements that I would question. It seems to me that religious belief inevitably comes into the public sphere. I mean, it would be a bit odd if somebody, you know, goes to church on Sunday and then that's it, and they don't carry that sense of religious principle into their political life.
It would be odd. And, for example, if you believe that people who don't believe in your particular religion are going to hell, I could well imagine that if I believed that, I would be tireless in my efforts to convert them, because after all...
No, I'm not talking about conversion. I'm talking more about feeding the poor and clothing the naked, those sort of religious injunctions in the gospel which have very clear political implications.
But you are surely not suggesting that feeding the poor and clothing the naked are a monopoly of religious...
No, I say no before you even finish your sentence, yes. But what I'm saying is that people who have those religious convictions, it's obviously going to find expression
in
their politics.
Many parts of the world, of course, they are almost monopolies of certainly the Catholic Church. I did a piece where I'd wandered the world in 2004 in Honduras and the Philippines, where they're central to democratic democratization and fight against poverty, and in Honduras to the ecological movement. So in theory, they are doing good work in those areas.
I'm sure that's true. I would like good work to be done on the basis of evidence-based belief, and if it's looking after the future of the planet or looking after the poor, I think that there are good reasons for doing it, which are nothing to do with religion. And it's certainly true that people of goodwill, whether they're religious or not, should cooperate together in doing that. So I have no problem with that. And I can see that what we're talking about is a point of political tactics, really. I can see your political point, Madeline, when you say that I won't win any converts by laughing at people. And I think that's a serious point, which I've got to take seriously. Since my primary concern as a scientist is with the truth of religious propositions. Is there, as a matter of fact, a God? Is there, as a matter of fact, such a thing as a miracle? Do we survive death? These are interesting questions, and they're the ones that mainly concern me. Now, when we come to political issues, like what are we going to do about poverty, what are we going to do about disease, and so on, then I have no quarrel with cooperating with anybody who makes sense about those issues. What I do have a quarrel with is people who bring religion in as though religion was the only or primary motivation for doing such good things, and that's very, very common. You'll find remarkably common among religious people. They cannot understand that a non-religious person can be good or moral or altruistic, or sympathetic, or empathetic, or have even artistic sensibility. And I'm sure you've met such people.
Well, it's funny, because, you know, one of the strangest things when I read your work, Richard, is, you know, I don't doubt that there are some of these loopy people around, because you have met them, you've even caught a few of them on camera. But I don't know where they're hanging out. I mean, I wonder whether you're not mainly talking about America, where there are types
of... To some extent talking about Latin America, but don't forget, I mean, you are working for the Guardian newspaper, you're surrounded by intellectuals.
That I don't think is the relevant frame of reference.
That's so true.
There aren't many Guardian people who would acknowledge religious belief, actually. So what I'm really talking about is the people that I meet through my religious community, my church, etc. Now, I don't doubt that there are a few of them who are a bit sort of loopy, but actually, Richard, the vast majority of the kind of believing Christian in this country wouldn't deny for a moment that there are good people who have no religious belief.
No, they wouldn't.
And also, I think what's extraordinary about a religious tradition at the moment is modernity has completely traumatised religious tradition. And the old stories and narratives and metaphors are in chaos, fragmenting in many ways, and that's why you get these extraordinary splits within churches, such as we're seeing in the Anglican Communion. And it seems to me that within that maelstrom is that some people have managed to expand their idea of God and belief to mean that actually agnostics, atheists and believers can sometimes actually land up in a very similar place in trying to define what is the nature of God, what is the nature of belief. I mean, you yourself said, if an Einstein, when he talks of God, well, I'm not that far away from that. Well, it seems to me that I'm not that far away from that either.
Ah, but then why do you call yourself a Roman Catholic?
Well, why not? Because in that community, I find great support.
By buying into Roman Catholicism, you're buying into all kinds of things which Einstein would have had nothing to do with. Einstein actually was an atheist.
Yeah, I'm not saying I am, like me and Einstein, there's no difference. But his understanding of God is that enormously different from what my own understanding is.
It really is, because if you're a true Roman Catholic, you buy into the Trinity, you buy into the transubstantiation, the virgin birth, miracles, Jesus is the Son of God. I mean, this is utterly, utterly different from the sort of... I don't even want to bring Einstein in because he was an atheist, but let's say a deist who believes that there is some kind of gigantic intelligence in the universe. That has nothing whatever to do with the details of a miracle-wreaking, sin-forgiving, prayer-answering, virgin-born God.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that that sort of popular culture of Catholicism, which Stephen has talked about, is just one manifestation. What I would say is that religion is not about scientific truth, and that was one of the great advances of science in the 19th century, was that it destroyed that claim of religion. But it is about another kind of truth. Now, you know, perhaps you're kind of thinking, oh, God, what kind of other truth is there? But I think that there is an emotional, spiritual truth of which these religions are, a metaphor too weak a word, because I think they have much greater power to transform and to develop a sort of spiritual life.
I take it you don't believe in the virgin birth.
Well, you see, we'll get into very complex territory because I'm not sure what belief is. I'm not saying that I know exactly.
Why not? I mean, either Jesus had a father or he didn't.
But what is belief? What is belief?
Belief?
Is it for you, it's an intellectual, evidence-based decision.
What else could it be if the claim is that Jesus didn't have a father? What else could it possibly be?
Well, I'm asking you, what is belief? What is belief? You see, the thing is, it's interesting. Karen Armstrong had a very interesting interpretation of belief. She says it comes from the old Germanic for I commit. Yeah. So do I believe that somehow that there was some sort of physical bypassing of sort of, you know, natural causes? I don't know. I'm agnostic on that, which makes me an agnostic Catholic.
Why are you agnostic on that? I mean, don't you accept it's
because
a simple matter of fact?
Because I think it may indicate, well, no, fact.
Why not? What's wrong with fact?
Because there's some truth here which is not about evidence and it's not about fact. But I don't quite understand it.
Well, I'm glad you don't, because I certainly don't.
No, well, that's fine. That's fine. Hopefully I've got a bit more time left to work it out.
What is the end game for you? Is it that we have a society with no God and no religion?
Let's say the end game for me would be a society in which we base our beliefs upon evidence, publicly testable evidence, and therefore it's possible to have an argument without retreating behind a kind of evasion which says something like, what do you mean by belief? What would it mean to be a fact that Jesus had a father? I mean, that seems to me to be an absolutely straightforward case of evasion of a simple issue. There may be other cases which are very difficult, but something factual of that form, did Jesus turn water into wine? Did Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead? Those are factual issues, and maybe he did and maybe he didn't, but I don't think you can retreat behind saying this is a spiritual truth, not a literal truth. Either it happened or it didn't.
I'm sure these are metaphors, aren't they?
Metaphor for what?
Well, for man's attempt to understand something he can never understand.
Just to go back to the point about ridicule, does this mean that perhaps you need to think of another tactic? Does it mean some sort of shifting of the strategy?
I'm genuinely uncertain. I'm not a good politician, and I recognise that I may get things wrong. And this is particularly true in the creationism evolution debate in America, where there's no doubt, and of course you will agree with this, that evolution is true. But we have a political battle on our hands, which is to stop the subversion of American scientific education. Now, I'm not politically good in that battle, and I've admitted that.
You're a recruiter for the other side.
In a way. I mean, I met the lead lawyer for our side, so to speak, in the famous Dover, Pennsylvania trial, a man called Rothschild. And we had a conversation, and at the end he laughingly said, well, thank goodness we didn't call you as an expert witness. And I said, well, of course, I mean, I quite understand. I would have refused to come as an expert witness because counsel for the other side would have said, Mr. Dawkins, is it true that your Darwinism has led you to atheism? And I would have had to have said yes. And he would have said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my case rests. Because in America...
That famous trial in the 1920s would have a very different outcome, had you...
Well, yeah.
It's funny because I did write a column saying effectively that, which Dan Dennett was furious with me about. He said I got it completely wrong.
It's almost a cliché. I mean, indeed, it is a cliché. But you see, to me, it's a matter of which is the battle we're fighting. I mean, I care passionately about the true nature of the universe. And so I care about the fundamental issue of whether there actually is an intelligence or not. For me, it's not a spiritual, it's not a symbolic issue, it's a factual issue. And the evolution one, I could swallow
Richard, I just wanted to come in because I think that's really interesting. That's clarified for me where the real dividing line is between us. Because I think perhaps it's more pragmatic. But what I care passionately about, just as passionately as you, is about how human beings do or don't get along. So the truth of the universe is in a way something that I end up, you would say incoherently, I'm sure, and I wouldn't argue with you, but there are large parts about the nature of the universe which I'm quite agnostic about. And it's quite interesting how the Buddha was very agnostic. People would say, do you believe in a creator God? He came from, after all, a Hindu tradition. And the Buddha would say, I don't know. You don't need to worry about that. The really key issue is how you get on with your fellow human beings. And that's why I get so, you know, I think it's
aren't
so...
Aren't you almost, Richard, looking for another God? You're looking for something to replace God, and in that you have science or Darwinism.
Let me answer what Madeleine has just said, because I was trying to get to that earlier, and that's what I started out trying to say. That, of course, is the difference between us. I'm interested in truth, you're interested in human beings. And it's really as simple as that. And I believe that that is the key to a great deal of misunderstanding and apparent argument. When we have an issue involving human beings, when we're going on a political rally, when we're demonstrating against the war in Iraq or something like that, I will wave my banner with everybody else, and that's what I do as a political activist. But as a scientist, I care about what's true. And I don't say I know what's true, but I think it's a very important question. I don't say there are different kinds of truth, there's spiritual truth and there's absolute
truth. But surely
you
recognise a sort of emotional truth. I mean, in your private life, science doesn't really help you very much in making sure that you're a decent and kind and loving person to your immediate...
That's a quite different question, and I agree with that. But when I asked you the question, did Jesus have a father or not, that's not a question of that type, of the type, do you love your husband or your wife? That's a question of simple fact. Either Jesus had a father or he didn't.
Well, what
that's
I was
not
just
a symbolic
trying to suggest,
truth or a mythical truth.
Well, I was trying to ask whether you have a very, very clear understanding of scientific truth, whether there were other kinds of truth. Or do you just think there's only one?
No, of course there is. I mean, there are other kinds of, for example, questions of right and wrong. I mean, is it right to tell lies? Is it right to...
Or emotional truth. I'm quite interested in this. It's not like I've worked this through before.
Okay.
But times of crisis in your life, are the points where you work through to a process of this is emotional truth. You know, I have learnt something about myself, something about another person, how I behave in certain situations.
Yes.
Would you use...
Yes, that's why I say that I could be moved to tears by the St. Matthew Passion. So I'm not sure I'd use the word truth. I mean, I'd say that I respond emotionally to music, poetry, sunsets, etc. But when we're talking about at least a certain kind of truth, did something happen or not? Is this table made of wood or not? Is this day or night in England? These are matters where you should not be retreating behind obfuscations like emotional truth and spiritual truth.
Well, certainly not about the table. I totally agree about
well,
that.
Yeah, okay.
The table exists.
And it's made of wood.
Well, there might even be philosophers who worry about the table.
Yes, exactly. And scientists who would worry about the table.
In whatever sense we agree that we're sitting at a table, in that very same sense, it's got to be either the case that Jesus had a human father.
You're very worried
didn't.
About this question, aren't you?
No,
I'm
latching onto it because it stands for a whole lot of other things. I think that there is too much obfuscation, too much retreating, especially among people, not of the fundamentalist kind of religious person,
but
of the sophisticated, theological sophisticated.
Who you've accused of giving cover to the fundamentalists.
Yeah.
Looking from the outside, I mean, your book, other books attacking religion, but fundamentalist religion is on the rise. I mean, you appear to be losing the argument in large parts of the world.
Yeah, so what? I mean, as I said, I care about truth.
What I would disagree with you about is I think it's not religion causes fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is the traumatic experience of globalization on countries which are deeply poor, very, very unequal, politically humiliated and powerless. Fundamentalism emerges from the impact of traditional societies meeting a global world in which they are very much a marginalized partner. Religion becomes a source of identity. I don't think religion causes fundamentalism. I think fundamentalism is a response to globalisation.
Okay. I mean, that's an interesting point, and I take it once again you're thinking of Islam, but you could even make that case for
Christianity
in America, maybe.
Of all fundamentalists.
I think that it could be that the rise of the kind of loony fundamentalist Christian right is a kind of inferiority complex to the what they see as a kind of threat from the intellectual East Coast. Yeah. Liberal New York Times reading.
Absolutely. Insecurity is the word that I would use. You know, those local small town religious churches that you describe, there's a sense of powerlessness. There's many aspects of globalisation which have actually disempowered local communities.
Well, I understand that. I'm not the kind of person, however, who's going to compromise my my quest for scientific truth. For example, in the case of evolution, I'm not going to go to the Bible Belt of America and say, I deeply sympathize and respect your political struggle, and of course you must teach children creationism if you want to. Not a bit of it. I mean, I'm a scientist. If they're talking nonsense, I'm going to tell them they're talking nonsense. That makes me a bad politician. And I'm not trying to be a good politician. I'm trying to be a scientist.
I support with you on the evolution, teaching evolution in schools. I've got no problem with that at all. And you're absolutely right.
You might worry about upsetting people or offending people because of their political struggle.
I think if you want to get your message across to that constituency, then to tell them that they're also guilty of child abuse is not really going to help you. And so, you know, I can't understand the strategy because it seems so offensive and antagonistic, unnecessarily antagonistic. These are people who feel desperately insecure anyway.
Why do you use the word offensive? I mean, you could use the word offensive. Well, if you do, I'm happy about that, but provided you will also accept that if you go to a Republican and say George Bush is an idiot, that also is offensive and therefore you shouldn't say it.
If you said to George Bush he's abusing his children, I mean, it seems to me that our feelings about our children are about the most sort of sensitive, precious emotions. I mean, you know, what does it feel like for you if somebody said you're abusing your child?
Well, I've used that phrase for two things. One is the labelling of children when they're too young to know. And I've let me...
But your children are always labelled.
Let me finish.
Yeah, well, you know.
One is labelling children, and the second is things like hellfire, which terrify the daylights out of them. And, of course, you don't do that.
Of course not.
No. But there are hundreds of thousands of people who do that. And you are deluding yourself if you think that all religious people are people like...
No, of course.
Archbishop of Canterbury and things. I mean, they're not... Many of these people are not nice people. They are telling children that they're going to roast forever in hell. I call that child abuse, and I think you do too if you think about it.
Of course I would think that was child abuse. Yeah. But it's back to this point that I think it's too sweeping, too many generalisations. There are many forms of child abuse. And if we start all flinging this around, I just think, you know, how does it help?
But do you reject all non-secular education? And would you ban faith schools or deny them charity status?
I have said very clearly in The God Delusion that I'm in favour of religious education, that I'm in favour of teaching the Bible, whatever the holy book is of the culture. You can't appreciate literature.
What about Islamic schools?
Well, in Arabic culture, you've got to know the Quran or you can't take your illusions. So, yes, I'm in favour of teaching comparative religion, and teaching children that religion is an important phenomenon, an important cultural phenomenon, anthropological phenomenon. The one thing I'm against is teaching a child, you are a Catholic child, or you are a Muslim child. That's very different from teaching the child, there are people called Catholics and they believe so-and-so, there are people called Anglicans, they believe so-and-so, people called Muslims who believe so-and-so. That should certainly be taught children. What should not be done is to say to a child, you are a Catholic child, any more than, as I've said, you are a postmodernist child or you are a monetarist child.
It seems ridiculous that in a debate about these eternal questions, we've run out of time, but we have, I'm afraid. Thank you so much to Richard Dawkins for coming in today and to Madeleine Bunting for taking part in this conversation. If nothing else, I hope we've demonstrated that people who have contrasting perspectives on an issue, which in many parts of the world is proving increasingly inflammatory, can air their differences in a civilised manner. If you want to make a point about any of the issues raised in this debate, there is a discussion forum at commentisfree.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.